Joining us again on Animal Concerns of Texas is Steve Wells. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
My pleasure, Tom. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Steve. Hey, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about your experiences in Alaska again, since that was really interesting last time we had you on the show a couple weeks ago?
Oh, sure. I'm always happy to talk about Alaska. I definitely left a big part of my heart in Alaska. Well, it was interesting. I had done, some outdoors trips, but for the first 25 years of my life, I lived in Chicago, in the city. So it was a big change. And what drew me most was the incredible wildness of the place and the wildlife there, and the opportunity to, be in these amazing untouched wilderness areas. So I did a lot of travel all over the state by, land and foot, and also by kayak. And one thing you get used to, one thing that fascinates people about Alaska more than anything is, the bears. And everybody wants to know, what's it like to hike in bear country and so forth. And of course, there are places you can do that in the lower 48, but basically the entire state of Alaska, including like cities like Anchorage, are bear country. And so it is something you make your peace with. And, I had in all my time, I had many, many encounters with bears in the wild. And you just get used to it. It's a funny thing. Like I, like most people, had a lot of fear around that when I first started getting out in the wilderness in Alaska. But eventually you sort of get used to it, and you realize that for the most part, they don't really want anything to do with us. So as long as you don't surprise them, and you make noise when you're going through brush and so forth, so they know you're coming, they'd just as soon move out of the way. But it added for me, it added an element of awareness and sensitivity. And I think, just the feeling that you're maybe not top of the food chain for a while was an incredibly liberating experience for me. And I've heard other people talk about that, and it's really true. There's just something, you're really tuned in to sight and sound and smell, and it's sort of like, it just commands a respect for nature and wildness that I really enjoyed. So yeah, I had a lot of great experiences up there, doing trips, from the Arctic down to the, the southeastern part, on the ocean, and paddling and so forth.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a beautiful place. I know Liz has been there. I'm yet to go, but I know when my experience
Liz hasn't been there.
Oh, I thought you had been there.
No, Liz would love to go there, but has not been yet.
Closest I think I've gotten is Glacier National Park in Montana, and I was one of those ones who was very scared in those first moments doing any hiking, and felt like I was clapping every 30 seconds to make sure that my presence was known to not come across any wildlife. But that's an interesting thing, right? It's like we grow up in the city and we don't have that experience, and how amazing that you got to live through that, and how different too that, it's sort of my time at the Animal Legal Defense Fund that I've learned about the sort of the proliferation of roadside zoos, and how different that is in terms of the experience with how animals should be living. And I had no idea, how prolific they were. And, through some of the lawsuits that ALDF has, I think has really helped raise the profile of the experiences of captive wildlife.
Yeah. That's exactly right, Tom. I had no idea until much later in life either, just how prevalent these roadside zoos are, and just how easy it is to just buy exotic wildlife, and the internet has only exacerbated that situation. And this was another area where, ALDF saw an opportunity, based on, you know, we talked in our last time about the disconnect between, you know, a nation of people that I think largely consider themselves to care about animals and to be protective of animals and so forth. And yet our laws just don't line up when it comes to that. And that's a problem. It's also an opportunity, you know, closing that gap. It means that, you know, we've got the support of the public by and large. And you can see that whenever the public gets an opportunity to vote directly on issues that impact animals, tends to be overwhelmingly in favor of more protections. And, you know, I saw that in Alaska. The very first ballot initiative campaign I worked on was to stop land and shoot hunting of wolves in Alaska, which literally allowed you to use a plane to go out and shoot wolves, which was part of the state of Alaska's never-ending war on predators, particularly wolves, in order to, in its view, create more moose and caribou for hunters to shoot, sort of eliminating the competition scheme. And but anyway, we won that ballot initiative, you know, even in Alaska, states that, you know, has an incredibly strong, you know, hunting and trapping lobby and so forth. And then on up to, you know, ballot initiatives to protect farmed animals, like in California and Massachusetts recently, sweeping reforms of many of the worst farmed animal practices in factory farms. So this was, the wildlife issue was a whole other area where, you know, I think people are just, you know, in awe of magnificent wild animals, bears and tigers and these sorts of things. And yet it's very relatively easy to buy them, and the oversight of the market and what happens to these animals through these transactions is absolutely just practically non-existent for all practical purposes. And so again, when there's a huge disconnect like that, that's a ripe opportunity to both try and enforce the paltry laws that do exist, and then to push for stronger laws. And you know, again, I think we see the public by and large being very supportive of these efforts. But once these industries established and there's money to be made, they become very difficult. They become, you know, difficult from a political perspective because they, you know, wealth and money is power. And that tends to be what we're up against in changing laws. You know, the wealth and power of industries that don't want to change against, you know, public and grassroots support that want to see greater protections.
But it can work, right? Because, like, I remember when I first moved to El Paso here, there was a tiger truck stop just east of El Paso, where there was a tiger at a gas station in a cage that, you know, you could pay a few dollars to go see. And actually, one of the people that was involved in our veg society here in El Paso was behind putting an end to that. So I think it is a place where, you know, grassroots effort can really help build momentum to help change these laws and draw attention to the atrocities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And really that's what it takes. And that was, you know, it's the wealth and power of the industries versus, you know, grassroots support. And that's really important because, you know, when you can organize people like you're talking about around a particular issue, you know, animal activists have the numbers, you know, animal advocates, have the numbers to bring to the table when you're trying to do things like pass legislation. And, you know, if you can get these cases in court, you know, the courts often see the folly of how the law is being applied. And so ALDF has had a real string of successes, you know, which really have changed, I think, the captive wildlife industry, and we're continuing to work on these cases. We had one case in particular that was against a roadside zoo in Iowa, that where we were able to establish for the first time ever that the Endangered Species Act, which you know, a law that most people know and love because of the tremendous success it's had in protecting and restoring populations of wild animals that are endangered. But we argued for the first time in this case against a roadside zoo called Cricket Hollow Zoo in Iowa, that the Endangered Species Act protection should protect members of endangered species that are in captivity as well. And that brought a range of stronger protections to bear. And we were successful in that case, arguing it on up to the appellate court and winning. And because of that, and you know, when you win an appellate case, that's how you set legal precedent, which means that then you can use that win and the fact that it was that you won an appeal as a precedent in further cases. So we have used that precedent that was set in that case in numerous other cases, resulting in being able to get many, many animals, hundreds of animals at this point, if not in the thousands by now, out of roadside zoos and into proper sanctuaries where they can live in much more naturalistic settings. And some of the conditions at these places are just absolutely horrific. And while the numbers of captive wildlife don't come anywhere close to, you know, something like factory farming or even puppy mills, you know, there's another element to the suffering in these places, and that is that many of these animals will spend their entire lives there. Sadly, and yet somehow mercifully, animals on factory farms tend to live very short lives because they tend to be slaughtered at a very young age. Whereas animals in a roadside zoo setting, which can be equally horrific to what we find in factory farm settings, in some cases, can spend their entire lives there and live with, you know, untreated injuries and diseases and in absolute squalor. So it's a really important, you know, it's another important way to move the law forward to protect animals and build on precedent and build on the fact that there is no public support for these kinds of things. It takes time, but it really, you know, that's a good example of a legal strategy that follows a lack of laws and a lack of enforcement, but has a strong support from the public at large, and many legislators, I should say.
Right. And a model, I think, that, you know, after ALDF established, is one that even other organizations look to as case law that they can build upon for the work that they do. So the impact is even greater beyond just the work that the Animal Legal Defense Fund is doing. Is that it's helping others carve a path. And you know, I think, relatedly, if memory serves me correctly, I think it was, you know, that truck stop that was in West Texas was owned by Michael Sandlin and his father. And before he moved to Louisiana, where he had a truck stop, and the Animal Legal Defense Fund was involved in a case there. Steve, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about Tony.
Yeah, Tony the Tiger, and there are people who know ALDF as the group that sued to try and free Tony the Tiger from the Tiger truck stop in Louisiana, because that case got a lot of media, which you know, again, makes the point about you know, that, like you said, Liz, that you know, grassroots activism and being motivated by the plight of animals in captivity is really powerful tool. The outcome in that case was sad and indicative of sort of the difficulty that you face in challenging these situations. We ended up filing multiple lawsuits in that case. And the sad part is that Tony died still in captivity before we had exhausted all of the cases. And so, of course, the case became moot. But through that process, you really saw the great lengths that the captive wildlife industry and the people involved in it will go to try and protect their trade and to protect their quote unquote right to own animals as their property and how that outweighs any concerns about how those animals are treated, which is a really shocking but all too common view of these wild animals. And of course, you know, early last year, just when the pandemic was starting and people were at home watching Netflix, there was the very disturbing series about one of the big players in captive exotic big cats, particularly tigers, and that was what was the name of that series?
Tiger King.
Thank you. Yeah, Tiger King, and that really brought to the fore, you know, some of the seamy underbelly of the illegal wildlife trade and the legal wildlife trade both, because both of those things go hand in hand. And so thankfully, you know, I think largely on the publicity of that and then campaigns by groups, including ALDF at the national level, have pushed to pass the first major sweeping law to protect big cats. It has not gone all the way through into law yet, but it has passed in the House, and we're hoping that it will pass through. And that's the Big Cat Public Safety Act. And that's another way that, you know, folks can get involved and support legislation like that. And if people, you know, are interested in signing up for ALDF's alerts and to stay tuned on those sorts of things, you can go to ALDF.org. And sign up for our e-alerts and so forth, and we can let you know when your voice needs to be heard on those sorts of things.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about sort of the criminal justice program and also, you know, how these laws have evolved, you know, briefly over the last couple of years.
One of the things we do that's been very successful and is a resource that any animal group can use or any animal advocate is our annual state rankings. So we rank all the 50 states and the territories by the relative strength of their animal protection laws based on a whole number of metrics about elements of their animal protection laws. And, you know, over the 20 years that I've been at it, we're in our 15th year, perhaps, of doing the annual rankings. The encouraging thing is that, you know, it's been a measure of steady progress. You know, we're not seeing, it's not like we're seeing any state that's really backsliding. I mean, there may have been one or two that have backslid in some particular way, but overall, you know, the states are all moving up. And what's great about the resource is, one, that it's a powerful tool that's at the hands of any, you know, animal advocate in any state who wants to use it to make an argument for stronger laws in their state. And secondly, you know, it becomes a pride thing. You know, nobody wants to be last. And, you know, if animal advocates go in and say, you know, why is the great state of you know, Kentucky 50th, you know, and that's changed now. For a long time, Kentucky was 50th, but then I think in the last year's rankings, New Mexico fell to the bottom of the heap. And, you know, that's something that has actually proven to be very effective for, you know, even legislators in states to go before their fellow legislators and say, look, you know, we're at dead last in these rankings. And how is that possible when our constituents care about animals? And this is a disgrace. And so, yeah, it's a powerful tool. And I encourage people our most recent one is up, as you all covered, as you said, Tom, but if you want to check it out, go to ALDF.org and look up our state rankings. And there's a beautiful map. You can click on your state and you can learn more about how the rankings are formed and trends over time and all that sort of stuff.
I know ALDF has made some strides in this in particular recently. Maybe if you can hit on those real quick, that'd be great.
Yeah. Well, you know, ALDF's work encompasses animals, all different kinds of animals, from companion animals to wildlife to farmed animals and so forth, because we're looking to change laws. And often, you know, changing laws in one area helps animals in another. But also, you know, fundamentally, you know, what we're talking about is the very concept of justice. And, you know, we've seen that, you know, not unlike society at large, you know, there are differences in the participation of you know, people in our movement. And one glaring thing that is that has been true for as long as I've been part of a movement is there is a profound lack of diversity, racial diversity is I'm talking about in the movement at large. And we see that at most of the animal protection groups that are working on change as well. And, you know, it behooves us, just as I think there's a national reckoning about, you know, providing fair and free, you know, access to all the issues of concern to people. I think we need to look at that and try and understand why that's the case and try and make change. So, you know, I think it's a challenge for every organization in the movement and for the movement itself to change that paradigm.
Yeah, I think it's a great effort. And like you said, helping these students just see that it's a possibility of how they can apply their skills to help animals. I think a lot of law students still today don't really consider, you know, animals having legal rights. So I think it's great just as an eye opener. Can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more? I know you've mentioned the website a couple times, but if you want to give it one more plug and any other plugs you want to give. We'd love to hear that.
I'm happy to. Yeah. So our website again is aldf.org. And you can sign up for our newsletter there. You can also find us on social media. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, et cetera. And feel free to, you know, like and subscribe our pages and get updates that way. And in addition to learning about the cases we file and the things that we're doing, we often also ask for help from supporters and animal advocates in helping to get laws passed or bring attention to particular issues. So we would really appreciate your involvement as well.
And of course, you can become a monthly donor too. That's the best way to help, I think, right? Even if it's a small amount, if you do it monthly, it makes a big impact.
Thanks, Liz. Yeah, absolutely. And we find that a lot of people like that sort of, you know, monthly donation amount that's, you know, not one big chunk and just happens automatically. That's the way I do it personally as well.
We've been talking with Stephen Wells, Executive Director and CEO of the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Steve, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me, Tom and Liz.
If you like information about a vegetarian or vegan diet, you can go to the Veg Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button. Until next time, I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh for the Animals, the Earth, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
Support for the local production of ACT Radio on KTEP comes from the estate of Maxie Templeton.